Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call. Click Grainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I think that was good, actually.
So bad on my end.
It wasn't the worst.
I mean, we've done a lot worse.
We definitely had a lot worse. But hey, welcome to Bros a Collab, because this is like our first official collab.
How exciting.
And I know, and we've never done it before. Especially together.
Yeah.
Like Fast and Furious, it's all about the family.
Oh.
Fast 9 is coming. Just get ready for it. But joining us is someone very, a friend of the show, especially on Instagram.
Oh, yeah.
She loves my memes. We talk all the time. It is Ashley.
Hello.
And do you want to just introduce yourself in the show?
Yeah, I host a show with my partner, Bianca. It's called Let's Get Dark. It was called Creep It Real a few months ago, but it got changed. And we just talk about anything from true crime to paranormal, a lot of weird stuff. Talk about, like, I like to talk about corruption, like police corruption a lot. That's one of my favorite picks, but I just like to cover those types of topics. I'm sorry. I'm nervous. I'm a little nervous now. Okay, so.
No, we love to hear it.
Yeah.
And so we've been talking for a little bit about doing collabs,
yeah.
And we're both like busy as hell.
Yes.
We finally pinned down the actual time to do it.
We did.
And doing a true crime iceberg. So now I'll explain what an iceberg is. Much like me, it's small at the top, and then it gets wider at the bottom.
Ooh, yes. I didn't know this, Andre. I've known you a while now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yes. You never noticed my birthing hips.
Oh, my.
You, never mentioned it before.
You got them Pixar mom hips?
I got them ghetto waitress hips.
You're not showing
them. I'm going to knock over your coffee table. But, yeah, so we're going to split out light and get darker as we go down.
Sure.
But, Ashley...
Yeah.
That's Titanic, this shit.
That's
Wait,
Titanic.
Andre, what's the name of the show again?
Damn it.
God. I was going to say something, but I forgot as he started talking.
No, it's okay.
Robert.
Yeah. It's Bros a Murder.
Iceberg, is it as you get deeper in the iceberg, is it like less well known, or is
yes.
it like just darker?
Less well known, darker. Yeah.
Yeah, you guys get some stuff I haven't even heard of before.
I was gonna say, yeah, the case that I researched for was very cool, very
yeah,
interesting.
I didn't hear about mine either, and I was like, oh, this is a lot. That was dark.
To be honest, though, I honestly hadn't really looked into a couple of the ones that I covered. So I'm starting with the Grime Sisters, who I don't know if any of y'all had ever heard of them, but I hadn't.
No.
Okay. Well, I guess prepare yourselves for their tale. In December of 1956 in Chicago, there were two sisters, Barbara and Patricia. They were 15 and 12. They went to the Brighton Park Theater around 7:30 p.m. to see an Elvis Presley movie, Love Me Tender. And they were pretty obsessed with Elvis at the time. That was their 11th viewing of the movie. And they went and stayed at that movie for the second viewing. So that made 12 total viewings of Love Me Tender for these girls.
It was them hypnotic hips.
It had very tender.
It had to be.
Threw it in the circle.
It was crazy. I thought, you know, I think Titanic, embarrassingly enough, whenever I was in like seventh grade, I think I saw it 7 times. And
that's long movie too.
That's excessive.
My younger sister watched that movie a lot.
I don't know why it is that I did that, but I guess I wasn't alone.
That one scene on the VHS is just like wiped out because it's been rewound so many times.
I don't know what scene you're talking
the
about.
The hand grasping the glass. Oh, that was perfect. Yes. Oh, gosh. Anyway, so they lived about a mile and a half away from this theater in McKinley Park with their mother, who was divorced, and their two brothers, two sisters. It was past midnight. They never came home, and they were like super obedient, studious. They did whatever they said. So they told their mom, we're going to be home by midnight, and they didn't show up. By 2 a.m., their mom called the cops and reported them missing. But as we've seen and heard in a lot of missing persons cases, the cops initially thought that the girls had just run away, and they didn't take her request for an investigation seriously. So they had actually come up with this idea, the police, that the girls were so obsessed with Elvis that they ran away after their 12th viewing of the movie. They were just like so overcome with like hysteria that they ran away to find Elvis. And that's where they were. So they didn't want to really look into their disappearance at all. It was like weeks that they didn't look into it because they were like, these girls just went off to find Elvis, you know. Typical police work, I guess, but not great.
Yeah, if we're looking for most likely scenario, it's clearly that.
Yeah, I've heard some pretty shitty ideas,
Pops,
but that...
Especially coming from a group of people that, like, regularly interacts with, like, murderers and, like, criminals and know they're around.
Right.
Yeah.
And the girls were going to be walking, you know, walking home a mile and a half at midnight. So it was very likely that something could have happened to them. But Elvis himself made a televised plea for the girls to return home on January 19th, saying, if you're a good Presley fan, you'll go home and ease your mother's worries, which I just think is kind of a testament to what a bloviating dickhole Elvis was. I was just kind of like, okay, you know, Elvis.
Thank you, Elvis. Thank you so much.
He's just, you know, we know Elvis like appropriated all his moves and music from all other cultures, and then everybody else is here, you know, saying he's so great. So a little annoying. After way too long, the police eventually realized the girls had actually been abducted and didn't just run away to find Elvis, and then the investigation began to be taken more seriously. There were multiple different supposedly sightings of the girls in the days and weeks after their disappearance. But at the theater the night they disappeared, a girl from their school who actually knew them and was friends with them said that she saw them buy popcorn in the sessions in between the first and second showings. So they definitely were there and they definitely did see the movie. But after that, there was just teenagers that said that they saw them getting into a Mercury automobile with a young man that looked strikingly like Elvis. I know, the Elvis thing just really overtook this whole case. It is bizarre. Someone else said that they saw them boarding a bus heading to Chicago after the movie finished. A bus driver said that he dropped them off halfway between the theater and their home around 11. There were just tons of sightings everywhere. And I've seen that, you know, in missing persons cases where everybody sees people all the time. They're always getting reports.
Yeah, because people look like other people sometimes too. So.
Exactly. Everybody has a few people that look. So all that said, they began canvassing door to door. They distributed flyers. They searched canals and rivers. And the Grimes local church put up a reward for any information regarding anyone finding them or what happened to them. They questioned over 300,000 people. 2,000 were interrogated. And the case pretty much spiraled out of control and the trail ran cold. And then, about 1 month later, a man named Leonard Prescott was driving down German Church Road. It was about 16 miles from the Grimes home when he noticed something odd that he believed was mannequins just along the barrier at Devil's Creek that he was driving along. And as he continued driving home, he was like, well, maybe those weren't mannequins. And he turned around, went back, and it was actually Barbara and Patricia's bodies laying in the snow. It was terrible. They were naked and frozen and had been out there for a while because their bodies were so stiff that they had to allow them to thaw for like 24 hours before they could even perform any kind of autopsy on them. Barbara had blunt force trauma to her head and face and puncture wounds all over her body. They believed that she had had intercourse around the time of her death, which obviously was likely assault. Patricia had bruises all over her face and body. Neither of the girls had any drugs or alcohol or poisons in their system. And they actually had the stomach contents of the dinner that they'd eaten the night they disappeared in their stomach still. So it was pretty, I think that kind of leads the investigators to believe that they died about within like 5 hours or so of...
Yeah, when they went missing.
But the coroner could not agree with that opinion. There was like two different ones that were kind of fighting about what had happened. And one of them said that he thought that they were kept alive until at least January 7th. And then that they were left on the side of the creek whenever they were still alive because he thought that the thin layer of ice on their bodies indicated that they were still warm. But I also don't know how you can think that when the food in their stomach was from so far. It was like, you know, at least 2 weeks earlier. So I don't know how that would have still been in their stomach if they had still been alive, obviously. There were multiple theories. One was that a security guard told the police that he gave the girls directions to a friend's house that night and had seen them on the 29th, which meant that they were still alive. There was another guy, a restaurant owner. He said that he saw the two girls with an employee of his named Benny Bedwell, who ended up being the main suspect for the girls' murders. He said that he saw him helping Patricia walk because she was staggering. And a clerk at a hotel then said that she saw the two girls try to rent a room that night. There were just so many different people trying to say that they saw these girls. It's just crazy. The coroner, a different coroner, said that he believed that the girls were lying near Devil's Creek for weeks, dead, obviously, from the time that they were there. Due to snowfall covering their bodies, their bodies were kept and preserved in a good condition. The snowfall started January 9th and had only started to melt a few days before they were discovered. So he believed that they were likely killed immediately after they were found or abducted the night that they went missing, and they were stored elsewhere before that. And then they were left at the roadside once it started snowing. Whatever theories that anyone had, the girl's cause of death would eventually just be listed as murder and secondary shock. So that Benny Bedwell, he was a 21-year-old drifter who worked odd jobs in the Chicago area. He was the one that worked at the restaurant, and his boss had said he had seen him with Patricia and her sister. And he was arrested and interrogated for 3 days. He was eventually charged with the murders, where he signed a 14-page confession claiming that he and a man named William Cole Willingham had been in the company of the sisters up until January 7th. He said that they fed the girls hot dogs and then beat them to death, leaving their bodies on the side of the road, which obviously doesn't really fit with any of the actual evidence that was there.
Yeah. They didn't find like a bunch of Franks.
They didn't.
Yeah. But, you know, after 3 days of being interrogated, you'll sign
exactly.
Exactly.
He would later recant his confession, saying that he'd been held for 3 days. I'm sure he wasn't fed or wasn't allowed to sleep, and he was told that if he confessed, they'd let him go. Additionally, his other employer at the time, Ajax Consolidated Company, said that he was at work when the girls were abducted and had been at work every day since, so it wasn't like anything in his schedule had changed.
I love that police work.
It's really great. This story is really exemplified police I honestly can't talk to you guys today. I'm like, I'm so sorry. So anyway, there is another suspect named Walter Kranz, who was a steam fitter and a self-declared psychic. He called the police complaint line and told them that the sisters were dead and their bodies would be found in Lyons Township around the beginning of January. He refused to give his name, but they traced his call because he was a genius. And he said he was fairly accurate. They were found only a mile away from where he said they were going to be found, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he did anything. He was also suspected to be a person who sent Loretta Grimes a ransom note, which was confirmed by handwriting experts, and he would later be released without charge. So he was just kind of a scammer, obviously.
This fucking guy.
I know. There's always somebody like that around. There was another guy who was a 17-year-old who he at the time was thought too young to legally undergo a polygraph test. And he was legally too young to undergo a polygraph test in Illinois. And everybody thought because he was 17, like he shouldn't be thought of as a suspect. His name was Max Fleeg, and Captain Ralph Pettigrew convinced Fleeg to take one anyway, a lie detector test, even though it wasn't legal. And he would go on to confess to the murders during that test. But because the test wasn't legal, he wouldn't be charged and he was released due to lack of evidence. He would later be jailed for the murder of another woman, so it is very possible that he was the culprit in the murders of the two sisters. In more recent years, cold case detectives have pinpointed another possible suspect, which was this man, Charles Melquist, who was a confessed child killer responsible for the murder of Bonnie Lee Scott in 1957, which is another famous case. It was the same year that Loretta Grimes received a call from a man claiming to be the one who undressed the girls, saying one of them had deformed toes that crossed over each other, which was a fact that had not been made known to the public. So that was one of those instances where somebody has some information that was never made known. And so I guess, you know, it's possible that this Charles Melquist was the one that called Loretta Grimes and he had that information about the girls that nobody else knew. The night that Bonnie Lee Scott's body was murdered, so it's kind of around the same time as the girls, Loretta, their mother, received another call stating he got away with another one and that the police wouldn't be able to pin it on him. And then Bonnie's body was discovered less than a mile from where the Grimes sisters had been discovered. So it is definitely possible this guy was being a creepy killer, you know, calling the mom and saying weird stuff. And he would only end up serving 8 years of his 99-year sentence before he died. And there's a retired detective, Ray Johnson, that believes that Melquist killed the Grimes sisters, but also had an accomplice, as you might suspect, because it would be a little bit difficult, I would think, to abduct two girls with just you on your own, unless maybe you just overpower them and hit them in the head immediately. I don't know how else you would. Yeah. I don't know. But it's possible, very possible, that he had an accomplice. Johnson also believes that Melquist had ties to the top. See? Okay. He had ties to the mob as well as investigators that were working the Grimes case. And to this day, that the official case remains unsolved and open. So, never.
But which of all of these suspects looks the most like Elvis?
That's what I was about to say. I don't know. Maybe that 17-year-old is looking a little bit like Elvis.
Yeah, for sure.
Or it could have just been Elvis, guys.
For sure.
Elvis.
When I think about Elvis, I think of just Johnny Bravo.
Yeah.
Well, didn't Elvis marry Priscilla Presley when she was like 14 or 15 or something? Yeah.
He
was a creep.
Like 16 or something.
So maybe it was Elvis, and like when it comes down to a great thought. I never even really thought that that could be a viable option here. But
I never trusted him.
You shouldn't.
But if that ends up being the case, I will issue a formal apology to the police who theorized they went after Elvis.
That's true. Oh goodness.
So, but no, that was interesting. I never heard about that.
I hadn't either. Yeah, you know.
My case is like really weird because you put that up there. You're just like, yeah, you should look into this. I'm like, why do I want to look into this mystery room of 1046? And I'm glad that I did. It's a mystery room for sure. So January 1935, a man named Roland T. Owen checked into...
What was his name?
A hotel called Roland T. Owen. Roland.
I like that name.
Roland T.
You
Owen.
Like the name, well, Roland, the way or Roland flows.
Yes.
Owen.
Roland T. Olin, like that's.
Yeah, if I read that character's name in a book, I'm like, oh, you're about to die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, guess what? You touched the nail on the head. But yeah, so in January 1935, he checks into this hotel called President's Hotel in Kansas City. It may be crazy, but then maybe not. But he did check in without any type of luggage. But not maybe. Well, he had a toothbrush.
More suspicious.
Toothbrush and a comb. It was in the 30s, so yeah, he probably had like slicked back hair. He's probably a greaser. But notice I changed the accent up a little bit. I don't even know if that's right, but it happened. Right, yeah. I've been practicing. So he had no luggage besides a comb and a toothbrush. So I guess. Maybe he was like, but you know how like they had the meetups and stuff with like Craigslist? Maybe it was like the old timey Craigslist. He just posted.
Yeah, it's called Marty's List.
The local news.
I mean,
news.
That's not a crazy list, like stretch. Like honestly, the two things you would bring to a hookup in the what time of
it was by the hour?
What was the year?
A comb.
Yeah, you're bringing a comb and a toothbrush.
No, is that, no condom. No sheepskin condom.
No. Well, see, that's what the toothbrush is for.
Oh, that's terrible. Kelly's just like, oh my gosh, you guys. No. So a day after he checks in, some strange things started to happen. And what I'm about to tell you is the account of the housekeeping, the woman that was the housekeeper. So the housekeeper, Mary, she did what she was supposed to do, right? She goes in and cleans his room where she wanted to. And she went in around the time that most people would go in for house cleaning, which is the checkout time between 11 and noon. And I think they do this, or I think they go and check, because this is usually the time that people are not necessarily in their rooms. But Roland was in his room, and he locked the door from the inside, so he had probably the little jam thing, and she was trying to open it after she knocked on it. And she knocks, and Roland eventually answers the door. She told him that she could come back later, but he was just like, yeah, you could just come in and clean. So she, no, it gets weirder. So with some reluctance, she enters the room and she starts to clean it. What she notices is that the room was completely dark and empty, and the only thing that was on was just the dim table lamp. So I assume that he maybe had a migraine. Okay, I'm trying to rule out, okay, maybe this guy's not weird or not shady things going on. I just assume, oh, he probably had a migraine.
I think he's probably weird.
I don't think migraine...
Maybe.
I don't think migraines were invented in the 30s.
you got ghosts in your brain, kid.
One and done.
Take two leeches and call me in the morning.
Take this toothbrush.
So, as she was cleaning, they did have a small, awkward conversation where Roland said that he had friends that were going to come by, and he told her explicitly, do not lock the door on your way out. So Mary was like, all right, bet, I'm not going to lock the door, guy.
That's exactly what she said.
Yeah, probably. So, some hours later, after Mary has cleaned the room, she goes back to deliver towels, because back then they didn't just have, I'm assuming, towels that they just brought when they cleaned them. So they would take the room's towels, clean them, and then bring them back. So she notices that the door was still unlocked, so she just walks into the room and finds Roland laying on top of his bed that was completely made still, and he was fully dressed. And she said that it seemed like he was asleep.
Oh, Mary.
She did also witness... Bless her heart, as they say in the South. But, so she did witness that there was a letter on the table next to the bed, and it said, Don, I'll be back in 15 minutes. Wait. That's all it said. But that's the end of this part, however. And it continues to get strange, because the next day she goes back to do her rounds again, but this time the door was locked, but from the outside, which is expected, right? And according to that, what happens is she opens the door with the master key. She's like, let me go and see what's happening. And Roland was actually sitting, this is after she knocked on the door, but he was in the room as she was knocking on the door. He was in the room sitting in the corner, but the room was completely dark.
That's Blair Witch Project stuff.
So, right? Like, he's just sitting there. And so she's just like, okay, I'll do my job and I'll clean. So she's like cleaning and it's in silence. Like, he doesn't say anything to her. He's sitting in the corner as she's cleaning. Eventually, right? Mary's just trying to get, like, Mary's trying to do her job. She has people to feed, right? So eventually the phone rings and he answers it. And she said that the exchange on the phone was pretty much him saying that he didn't want to eat. Okay, maybe not weird. Maybe he's just a weird person. Maybe he, I don't know. I'm weird. So, yeah. So some time goes by and she leaves again and eventually brings back some more towels.
A lot of towels.
And when she gets... like, bro, what towels. Are you doing with these towels? Like, so when she gets to the door, she realizes that there are two voices in the room this time. And she lets them know, like, she knocks and says, hey, I have towels. And they're just like... we have enough towels. You're good. Go away, tits. yeah. Here's the thing, though. She knows that she removed all the towels from the room that morning. So Mary was just like, fuck it, and leaves them alone. So the same day that she heard two people in the room, a couple of more guests checked into that hotel. One was a woman who just came to visit her boyfriend and left the next day. And she stated when she was interrogated because something happened, she heard a lot of commotion, and the commotion was women and men talking loudly and cussing. She didn't want to let the front desk staff know, though, which I don't blame her because it's none of my business. Like, if you want to shout and scream, bet, go ahead and shout and scream. I'm not going to say anything. Like, that's not right. That would be Melinda. She'd like open the blind, like, what's happening? Like, can you go away? Like, I can never tell you anything. Like, leave these people alone. So the other woman that was there was looking for a man in the room that was supposed to be staying in the hotel, but she wasn't able to find the person she was looking for, so she eventually left. They were just two people that seemed suspicious, but nothing was ever found against them. Like, nothing ever came of those two people, but that was just a note that was part of the evidence that, like, these two random people came in and was just, like, kind of sus, but not sus enough to be prosecuted or anything like that. So fast forward a little bit to the next morning where there's this bellhop that got a call from the telephone operator because at the time... you had to go through an operator before you could get put onto, like, you know, whoever you're trying to call. And the telephone operator at the hotel was saying that the room that Roland was staying in has been off the hook for about 10 minutes and no one was using it. So the bellhop goes to Roland's room and notices that there's the do not disturb sign on the door. And the bellhop knocks on the door and yells at him to hang up the phone because it was off the hook. And he was just like, okay. He probably got the message. However, there was no response, right? So, about 2 hours later, the telephone operator called again and was like, yo, go check on that room because the phone is still off the hook. So now, the bellhop was like, okay, because I had this complaint twice, I'm gonna, like, just open it with the master key. So, he opens... it's not funny, sorry. He opens the room, his room, Roland's room with the master key and goes in, and he notices that Roland was laying naked on the bed, and he assumed, yo, this man had an awesome night. He's completely wasted. So he nicely and neatly puts the phone back on the hook and locks the door behind him and leaves. And of course he goes to the manager and just lets him know, like, yeah, this dude was, like, kind of messed up. He's, like, drunk or something. So an hour goes by and the phone... No, there's no towels. Yeah, no. Yeah, an hour goes by again. The phone was off the hook again. and the bellhop goes back up, and the bellhop, when he goes into the room, he finds blood everywhere. He said that Roland was sitting in the corner, the corner of the room, curled up with his head and his hands, with multiple stab wounds like all over his body, like it was just covered up with just looking gross, right? But everything was covered in blood. Everything from the towels that Mary nicely cleaned multiple times while he stayed there, to the walls, the sheets, everything was splattered with blood. So, of course, the police gets called. They come down, and they took him to the hospital, because I think at this point he was still alive. And it was found that Roland was tortured by whomever he was tortured by, and that he had cords wrapped around his arms and his legs and his neck. And again, he had multiple stab wounds. He also had a fractured skull, and his lungs were punctured by one of the stab wounds. And eventually he died. Apparently, the autopsy report said that they were able to conclude that some of the injuries were done before the bellhop actually went up to the room the first time. But because the room was so dark, which is why I presume that, like, the bellhop didn't realize that this had happened. Creepy. Yeah.
I've got a chill down my
spine. And he's sitting there naked. Like, you're not going to, like, stare at him super hard. Yeah. You're going to be like, oh, shit, my bad. I'm just, like, doing the phone.
But also, like, in the dark. If there's that much blood spatter, it had to have gotten on the person who did it. And how come no one ever noticed this person leave?
They might have, you know?
They didn't have towels to clean it up.
Exactly.
I don't think.
Yep.
Oh, fuck.
Well, they also said the reason why they thought the hook was off the phone so many times was because that as he would pick up the phone, he would pass out due to, like, the pain or, like, the injuries that he had. So, like, so they said that he probably was picking up the phone and passing out with the phone, like, dropping the phone each time. And during the crime scene investigation, they also realized that there were no clothes in the room. There was no toothpaste. There was no shampoo. There was nothing in the room. Everything was gone, like, as far as his personal effects. According to a website called That's Interesting, All That's Interesting, the only thing found in there were 4 fingerprints on the telephone. However, they were never identified. They also found out that Roland T. Owen never existed.
See, that name was too perfect.
So he was using, he was using a name, like a pseudonym, like he wasn't using his real name. And another crazy thing is that the reason he was staying at the hotel where he was murdered at was because he was at a neighboring hotel that had super high prices. And what's even more crazy was that after Roland died, the neighboring hotel came out and was like, yeah, some man stayed here a few days under the name Eugene K. Scott. And that person also never existed, like, ever. So, like, in the 30s, no one was named Eugene or no one was named Roland. I'm just kidding. But yeah, no one
Eugene
had that unique
wasn't invented
name.
Until so, came out.
So, yeah. So, later, people came forward and they're like, yeah, I know this person. There's this person who's with a woman or a woman named with the last name Ogletree. And she claimed that her son named Artemis Ogletree went missing.
Yeah.
And all the Artemis. When I hear the name Artemis, I think of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and Artemis on there. She's like, one of the first things she said, she's like, my name's Artemis. Bleached asshole.
That Who Pooped the Bed episode does the whole investigation.
Right? Yes. Like, and it was just completely ridiculous. Yes. Artemis is one of my favorite characters. But so there was no evidence on whether or not Artemis or Roland or Eugene was really her son, but they had no leads. So eventually they're just like, okay, Artemis is your son. We'll lay him to rest. But that's all that ever came of it. Nothing else. And they don't really, it's a closed case. However, every year the Kansas Police Department actually opens up the case to try to revisit it and try to look at new evidence or evidence as everything unfolds. And that is the story or the mystery behind
room 1046.
Ooh.
Crazy thing to me is like thinking that, first off, it sounds like a horrible story. Like someone's at a bar, like, hey, Mary, what happened to you last night? And she's like, man. But just the fact that, like, I'm thinking of the bellhop coming into the room, like in the corner in the dark, and just like the dude, please don't save me.
Ugh. The whole time, like maybe they were there when Mary was coming in.
Is that,
the whole time? Oh, that's terrifying. Yeah. That's one of my biggest fears, is that someone's just like lurking somewhere. And
you just have no idea.
No.
There was like 16 times in that story that I thought you were about to tell us he was dead.
Me too.
Like the first time they come in and he was just on top of the covers.
Yeah, I would say he was
like
dead
in all of his clothes. Yeah.
He was just chilling. This man was chilling a lot. He was just like,
whatever's
going to
happen
like,
is going to happen.
I'm going to make this weird. Let's get weird. Like,
wow.
No, that was.
Well, and like, I don't think he was on the run or anything because he didn't have bags.
That's the crazy thing, too, because there wasn't really, because he was using like a pseudonym, there wasn't really a way to understand like what was he doing, if he was running from someone or if he was running to someone or if he had problems with the mob, because maybe the mob was a thing back then or some shit. Like
he owed someone some money.
I don't know. Like
went there to like set up a payment arrangement or whatever, and they just said, we're going to.
And someone's Tommy gun was ready to go off, was ready to start blasting.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
But so let's go on to Robert. Let's just dig deeper into this iceberg. It's been good so far.
So not the 1930s. We are now in 2014, December 12th, and we are in Economy, Pennsylvania. A teenager going riding their bike. They find a human head.
Oh.
Just off the, in a rural section of Pennsylvania, a little bit off the road, they find the head of a woman. And they just call 911 and they calmly say, I found a human head. And then the cops show up and they're like, that's a whole ass human head.
You're right on the money with that one, kid.
No body, no blood. Just chilling off in a rural road, a human head. But it gets a little bit weirder. Because the head is entirely embalmed and well-preserved. And it was done with surgical precision. It was described more as a dissection than a mutilation.
Aliens.
Makes me think of Futurama.
Right?
So as they like continue to police work the head more, they find that underneath the eyelids, they have eye caps. So it's a tool that morticians use that has kind of like little spikes that come up into the eyelid to keep the eyes closed.
Oh.
If you like are laying someone to rest, so their like eyes don't look weird and keeps them closed.
I never knew about that. That makes sense.
But underneath the eye caps are red rubber balls.
That makes less sense.
What?
And they like interviewed a bunch of morticians and stuff. And this guy, they interviewed Kevin Morin, who was from the American Academy McAllister Institute of Funeral Service from New York. He said that they are not used in either the funeral profession or in organ donor networks. Nobody puts red rubber balls in the eyes. Morticians put eye caps on the eyeballs. They would never remove the eyes. There's no reason for them to do that. That's just like, you know, mutilating a corpse. And there's nothing unique about the rubber balls. They had like a made in China like stamp on them, but that's all they had to go on. there wasn't like a company name or a cereal or anything.
Were they kids' toys or something?
So one of the people they interviewed described them as something you might find in like a ball and jack set.
So like one of those little like quarter machine balls, bro.
Yeah.
Right. So a totally nondescript rubber ball that no mortician or organ donor network would use, but was done by a professional. So then people started talking about like, okay, so maybe this was an organ donor or a body broker, which I recently learned are two different things.
Can you explain what body broker
is?
Have you ever seen Repo? It's like that.
Wait, what?
So an organization that handles organ donation are typically done like through hospitals and all like surgical. So an iBank or an organ procurement organization only removes, typically nowadays, only the cornea from the eye. They don't take out the whole eye. And they also then dispose of the head because, just need the cornea. There's nothing else valuable in there. Like, you can't take any parts of the brain or, like, teeth. But, so body brokers are not medical professionals. They just buy and sell body parts. The cops were... In the interview I watched, they were talking about, like, yeah, I thought this was going to be, like, a really cut-and-dry case of, like, yeah, it has to be, like, an organ donation place or, like, you know, da-da-da-da. But we found out tons of people buy body parts, and our suspect list just kept going and going. Because apparently...
Well, yeah.
The military buys bodies, OSHA buys bodies, and it's to, like, test with them and, like...
So this... So the Army also buys,
stuff like,
stuff like live goats for that reason, too?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Do you want to ballpark how much a human head costs?
Okay, well,
50,000.
You said 50,000?
10,000.
8,000. I'm gonna go 15.
Okay, so this is a direct quote from a Reuters article that was about this case. A broker in Tennessee with no ties to the case, James Byrd, already had sold the news agency a cervical spine a few months earlier. Byrd informed Reuters that he could also supply human heads for about $300 each.
Wow.
Shut the fuck up.
What the fuck? $300, that's it?
Yeah, $300 cash. You'll get it in the mail. Don't worry about
it.
Well, but that's a ballpark. You know,
you want
$300.
You want no face or a face?
$250. It's missing the lower jaw.
That's cool.
So...
my head.
The only thing about it being a body broker is, again, the tissue's totally damaged because it was embalmed. So you can't really get anything value from the tissue. The eyes aren't removed in a way that you would typically associate with organ donation. And because of the embalming process, they can't really DNA test the tissue because of all the like chemicals that are now in the body. So pieces of information that they have been able to glean about who this person was... she was most likely 50 years old, or around that age range. She most likely died of cardiac arrest or some similar issue. Let's see.
I don't know how they figure that out without the rest of the body.
Good right. Question. So, toxicology tests suggest that the woman may have suffered from chronic pain and that paramedics tried to resuscitate her around the time of her death.
She might have had like some medication.
Yeah, so the toxicology they were able to do, cool science I didn't know existed is they did an analysis of the isotopes on the teeth and hair. So using that, they were able to do a toxicology. They examined isotopes from oxygen molecules that remained in the woman's teeth and hair. They also did that to kind of determine where she may have spent her last months. Based on, like, the food and water and things she was, you know, drinking. And that indicated a pretty big range in Pennsylvania all the way down to West Virginia. So she was most likely from that general area, that couple of states. They have done a 3D cast, not cast, but a sculpture of the head. And they're still searching. They have no idea who this woman is. They put her photos everywhere and, like, are trying to get people to identify her. But we don't know. And we don't know who did what with her head and what led that person to leave the head in a rural community in Pennsylvania.
Why did Chuck it, bro?
Yeah.
And why was it only $300?
Yeah, I feel like
and
That's like, I'm still confused. Like, how?
If you were, why? If you were doing it to get the eyes that you removed, why did you then put in rubber balls and eye caps to keep them closed? If you're just trying to keep the eyes closed, just put in the eye caps. You don't need to remove the eyes.
Or why do you even care about keeping them closed if
you're, gone. You're just going to dispose of it?
Yeah, if you're just going to throw it
out. So, no motive. No idea. Maybe like a body broker who just like really likes like messing with corpses. Like maybe it's someone who like sold the eyes to somebody and they removed the cornea. And he's like, well, I'll keep the head. I'm not going to just throw away the head.
And his wife was like, Frank, get rid of the head.
And maybe he's just really into taxidermy. And then, yeah, they were on a road trip through Economy, Pennsylvania, and they hit a bump, popped out the window.
We hate to see it. Kelly, your hands are...
Well, the balls were rolling, Kelly. Granted, what happened?
We don't know anything, but, like, my thinking is, like, she was embalmed when she died, so they had to have taken the eyes from her after she was embalmed. You can't really do anything with embalmed eyes, like, if you're going to test on it or something.
Yeah, unless you just have a sexual fetish with eyeballs.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, who knows?
Can't rule that out. You know?
I guess I don't know what the brokers, you know, supply to, but...
That's kind of frightening, to be honest with you, that there are body brokers. Really.
Yeah. Who's a weird job.
Who's the ones, like, regulating body brokers?
Exactly. So?
No one.
No?
And, like, it's actually, like, a huge issue, because...
I can only imagine.
They don't store like bodies properly often.
A new version of the grave diggers from, like, 200 years ago. Or
100%.
That's dark. That's real dark.
It's dark. The commodity market of your body after your death.
I just want to know who determines the prices of like body parts.
Right.
Like someone had to, like some community had to come to an agreement. Like, yeah, no, 300 for a head. That's reasonable.
Yeah, our guy James.
Is it per pound?
I don't know. 300 for a head.
So much per pound.
We're gonna go back in time, but not quite as far as the first stories. So, my story is about Charles Chuck Morgan, who went missing on March 22nd, 1977, the first time. Just remember that. Yep.
What?
First time he went missing. He...
Oh my god. I'm stressed out already.
He was missing for 3 days and then showed back up at his home, claiming to have been tortured. He was completely disheveled, had like... handcuffs and on his wrists and ankles, and couldn't talk, and claimed that a hallucinogenic drug was painted on his throat, so like he had to like wash it off or whatever a specific way or it would kill him.
Following.
Yeah, so he had to write notes to his wife when he first got home and basically tell her that she couldn't call the police, because if she called the police, it would be a death sentence for their entire family. He was a father of four, so just, you know. And, yeah, so she nursed him back to health. He became incredibly paranoid, as I would imagine one would be after an experience like that. Started wearing a bulletproof vest all the time, grew out his facial hair, made sure he was the only person dropping off and picking his children up from school. And then, 2 months later, he is kidnapped again. So, I guess this is about June of 1977. After about 2 or 3 days, a woman calls his home, addressing specifically his wife, Ruth, to tell her that her husband was okay and to read the Bible passage, Ecclesiastes 12:1-8, which reads... Men are afraid of a high place and of terrors on the road. Remember him before the silver cord is broken and the golden bowl is crushed. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. That's that.
I don't know.
God damn it, Bible.
Yeah.
First off, why is this dude going missing?
My first thought was like, he cheated. This is a made-up story.
I have a theory that he was involved with MKUltra. He was doing LSD testing with them, and he couldn't go to the police because they'd killed him.
You're very close. Spirit echoes. Oh, shit!
Are you serious?
No.
Wow, dude.
Well, I was about to say, dang, dude.
I'm just about to get so psyched on this story.
You're not like...
He
what?
Logs off. Yeah. I said he logs off.
And meeting.
Rage quit.
All right, so then 11 days after he goes missing, his body is found with a single gunshot wound to the head. So this is on June 18th, 1977. He is still wearing his bulletproof vest. On his body, he has a belt with a holster, a knife, and the gunshot wound was from his own 357 Magnum.
So the shot to the head, did it seem like a suicide shot or like more like an execution?
So that's the thing, it was ruled a suicide initially. But like, why are you going to go out into the middle of the desert and shoot yourself in the back of your own head while wearing all of the like shit? Yeah, to protect yourself. Adding to the overall strangeness, which, I mean, it's already pretty fucking strange as it is, there were, like, additional objects that were found at the scene, specifically around his car. Not so surprisingly, it was surrounded by more weapons and ammunition, as well as a CB radio. But the items in particular that were very weird were one of his teeth was found wrapped in a handkerchief. One tooth?
Yep. Only one tooth?
Wrapped in a handkerchief on the ground near his vehicle. And then the other really strange, like, thing that they found about his case was that fastened to his underwear was a $2 bill with last names on it and a map of the area where his body was found.
What the fuck?
Like, drawn onto the $2 bill?
Yes, drawn onto the bill. So, the, like, kind of noted stuff that kind of gives us more context is, so, one, he was a Freemason. I don't know how much that adds to it, but, you know, they're just kind of weird already.
Yeah, it's already.
Yeah, they like stones.
he worked in escrow, which, as many times as it's been explained to me, I still don't understand it, but... Like, he admitted at some point that with escrow, he was working with organized crime families. So basically, like, the mob, the mafia, and all that stuff.
I love how so far the mob has somehow played into effect in all these stories.
I was just thinking that.
It would make sense, though, because, like, escrow is just...
Money.
Like,
holding. Money.
Usually somewhat, like, yeah, somewhat, yeah, pretty much a money holder, like a third party, someone that holds money for someone else.
Well, and that's the thing, too, in particular, with this, like, this context is that he was doing escrow, and at the time, in Arizona, you didn't have to, like, have a record of the people you were working with in escrow for real estate. So, like, the only person who would know who the client was someone like Morgan, who was the agent handling the money. But he didn't have to release those names. Ugh. So he could work with basically whoever he wanted to.
Yeah.
See? That's why you want to let everyone know who you're working with.
Yeah. Well, and so he also had claimed at some point to be working with the Treasury Department in an investigation beforehand. So, yeah, it definitely kind of follows a trail back to the family, the crime families that he was supposedly working with. After his death, Ruth was visited by two men claiming to be from the FBI. They completely ransacked her house and, like, just tossed it around as though they were looking for something. She wasn't ever able to get their names, but there is one man in particular who was...
You gotta know your rights, man. You gotta know your rights.
Get the fuck out of my house. Who are you?
You don't get the fuck.
Well, so there was an investigative journalist who was following this story since it happened until, like, I guess the mid-90s or early 2000s, named Don Devereaux. And he researched into that whole thing as far as, like, a Freedom of Information Act request from the FBI to see who had done that to her home. And... this is a quote from him. He says, When I made a Freedom of Information Act request to the FBI, they had never heard of Mr. Morgan, despite the fact that they obviously opened an investigation, despite the fact that the FBI interviewed Mr. Morgan's attorney. They were all over this thing like a blanket for a while, but now they've never heard of the guy. He never existed. No card, no file, no nothing.
I'm imagining his reporters like seeing like a cigarette in his hand. He's like, they know nothing. Mm-hmm. They're all over.
Yeah. Like super aggro.
Yeah, and then one other interesting note is that this story was featured on Unsolved Mysteries in February of 1990. Yeah. Should cue the music. After it aired on television, a man who drove the exact same car as the man who did the investigative journalistic work, who worked across the street from Mr. Devereaux, was found dead in his car.
Mr. D, you wound up dead. What did you do? Sorry.
No, you're good.
Today is just...
But yeah, so he, I guess, looked similarly, worked across the street, had the same car as the journalist, and wound up dead. And so the journalist thinks that that was very much meant for him and not that other man. So...
Wrong place, wrong
car. Yeah, reason. Yeah. That's an L. Damn.
Oh, as well, there was another man who had contacted Don Devereaux about the case and said he had information for him. He was going to give him the information. I think it was like either late 90s or early 2000s that this happened. But before he was able to have a meeting, that man also wound up dead. And none of those murders have ever been solved.
It's the FBI. It's the FBI.
It's the government, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
It's
for sure.
100%.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably some NK, like with the hypnotic throat drugs.
I was going to say
hallucinogenics.
Yeah.
Well, and his behavior. Like, if you have any friends who, like, dosed way too hard, like, they get weird and paranoid afterwards.
They act sus. They act like how Battle's picture look right now in the back.
Bullet all the time.
Sorry.
So good. Yeah.
No, that's...
And, is the FBI. Oh, I love government conspiracy so much.
It's definitely the FBI.
The government's the best boogeyman.
For sure.
But I FBI agent listening, I
totally... Yeah, me and you are cool, bro. You've seen me go through some things. All right, so I guess we're finally at the end of the iceberg with my tale. And when I was reading it over, the one I picked, I was like, why is this at the bottom? It doesn't seem like that crazy until I dug a little bit deeper at the person who did the crimes. And how that was just insane.
Oh.
So I'll start into it. Now we're going to flash forward to November 10th, 1985. A hunter and a couple kids were going through the woods, and they came across a 55-gallon metal drum near a burnt-down store at Bear Brook State Park in Allentown, New Hampshire. They cracked open that drum like any random person would when they find a metal drum, and inside of it was an adult female and a young girl wrapped in plastic. Both had died of blunt force trauma, and no one knew it. So, around that same time when they're investigating, they, like, get the bodies out, couldn't identify them, and they buried them. And on a tombstone, it read, "Here lies the mortal remains known only to God, a woman of 23 to 33 and a girl 8 to 10. Their bodies slain and were found with the date they were found. May they rest in peace." This is the starting of the weird Bear Brooks murders.
It's already giving me Twin Peaks vibes.
Oh, no, it's very...
Exact same thing, yeah.
It's very Twin Peaks-y. So now, a couple years go by, and on May 9th, 2000, two young girls were found near the same exact site, also in a 55-gallon metal drum. The drums were not that far away from each other, and the police were like, oh, we didn't find the second one, even though it was in the same area, just because we didn't know we were looking for it. But like the first one, two kids just came across it and found it. Now, they believe that all four murders roughly happened around the same time. And according to investigators, the death were similar too. So they couldn't exactly say what it was, but they knew it was blunt force trauma just by the way, you know, the bodies were damaged. So now the adult female was identified as Honey Church and was determined to be Caucasian with Native American ancestry, 23 to 33, curly wavy brown hair, 5'2 to 5'7, and her teeth had like a lot of dental work, including fillings, extractions, and just like, you know, just normal dental work you get as you get older. The younger girl had also was like Native American determined and also had like dental work done too. The girl who was found with the adult female in a second drum was also later identified to be between 5 and 11. She has symptoms of anemia, crooked front teeth, and dysthymia, which is just like when your teeth are in front or spread apart. All this comes into a play of like how they found out who did it. Because they got really into like what they look like, and I fell into a rabbit hole about that too. The little girl, another child, was between 4'3 and 4'6 with wavy hair and no dental fillings. And the youngest girl, who was McWaters, they found out, was between 1 and 3, long brown hair, between 2 foot and like 2'6, and also had a gap in her front teeth. So now the reason they got so into detail about like the teeth work and stuff like that is because of how they do facial like reconstructions. And I'm going to show you why. Because like, you ever see a facial reconstruction and it looks weird to you? Like, really?
Uncanny Valley.
Really uncanny Valley.
Yeah.
So now I was like, why is that? And I read into it, watched an interview with someone who does it, and they said that they always exaggerate certain facial features. So let's say if you're like, oh, this person has buck teeth, we're going to make those teeth really big, because if we make them too exact to how they look like, they'll just be generic and no one will like notice who the person
is. I guess that makes sense.
But if you're someone who knows them and you know that they have buck teeth and you see this image of someone with really buck teeth who kind of looks like them, you're going to be like, wait a minute, is that blah blah? So that's why every time you see a reconstruction, they look really like an alien wearing a mask.
So, I was gonna say, I do that. It makes a lot of sense, and I feel bad because I've talked a lot of shit on some of those drawings.
Yeah, there's a reason they're not done well.
Like, that doesn't look like a fucking person.
That's how I was too. I was like, why is the thing? Like, what? I'll show you how like the girls look.
It's like the difference like, between Battle and then his picture behind him.
No, yeah, it's exactly. Like that. Yeah, wait, yeah. Let me try to share a screen.
Why does it...
Battle, you disabled share screen. Yeah.
Did I? Womp womp. Oh, no. Okay, see if that works now.
Okay. Did I hear... Do you see it?
No.
Come on. So here's the reconstruction.
Like...
Right?
That is so
looks
creepy.
Really uncanny valley, and then I'll show you what they actually look like.
He signed this. Dog, what?
And here's what they actually look like. Like, normal girls.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they
make... like side by side.
So, but yeah, so that's why they look kind of uncanny valley. So now back to the case. In the early days of the investigation, authorities like put out all the information they had. And all across the U.S. and some parts of Canada, too, just to, like, try to get any leads. At least 10 possible identities were ruled out, despite hundreds of leads, but getting out there. And the bodies at that time were not identified. You know, over the course of a couple years, the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children would continuously update and put out the pictures of the girls just to, like, anybody knew them. And this lasted up until 2015, actually. So now, continuing the investigation, in 2014, police announced that the DNA profiling had revealed that the woman and the oldest girl were maternally related. And that just means that they were either mother, daughter, aunt, niece, or sisters. So they were related somehow. So the girls that were found in two separate drums. So the oldest from the first one and the youngest from the second drum were related. In 2015, the woman was identified to actually be the mother of the two girls found in the second. Other forensic information showed that the women and the child all had lived together somewhere within the northeastern part of the U.S. The same tech that Robert talked about, where they were like, you know, isotopes with the hair and teeth and trying to pinpoint where they lived at. They did the same thing here, exactly. And so they found out they lived in the northeast, and they also found out that they died between, like, 2 weeks and 3 months of when they were all found. So they all died around the same time and were placed there all around the same time too. Now fast forward to January 2017, it was announced that a man named Dennis Budin, who had been missing since 1981, was somehow connected to the murders. Now Dennis disappeared in Manchester, Hampshire, and her youngest daughter, is a woman named Denise. And her youngest daughter and boyfriend, whose name was Robert Evans, had all vanished. Now, Evans later found out that he just took the girl somewhere and dumped her off. So, like, the mom went missing. The girl was just dumped in the woods by herself by Robert. That girl was found, and she grew up and, like, lived her own life. It kind of stayed in hiding for a couple years, and it came out later saying that, hey, I'm alive. I was that girl. But no one had ever heard of Robert, and that's for a pretty good reason, because Robert was never a real person. Robert was an alias of a man named Terrence Pedro Ramsey, aka the Chameleon Killer.
Oh.
Yeah, I didn't know who this dude was. So now the Chameleon Killer was just a serial killer who killed between like 5 and 11 people over like a decade, but there could be a lot more crimes out there. So now his DNA was tested, and he was the father of the youngest girl found in a drum. And people believe that he was connected romantically to the woman also found in a drum. And they're trying to piece all this together, but the reason they can't get any solid answers and investigate this dude, because he actually died in prison under a different name after he was arrested years like back in 2010 for killing his wife at the time. He was also married under a different name too. So the case kind of all stops there, because we just have no way to identify whether the Chameleon Killer actually also killed these 4 girls along with the slew of other murders that he did, just because he died in prison. But basically what
I think,
go ahead.
Like, everybody has that fear of, like, oh my god, maybe my partner's, like, a murderer. Or, like, maybe my partner's cheating on me. Or maybe my partner has a whole other family that then they murdered.
But he didn't only have a whole other family. He had, like, he was dating a bunch of different people. Like, so he was dating Honey back in 1975. Whatever happened when they went missing, killed her, or just, like, whatever. Went off to go date Denise. Same thing happened. Went off and started married someone else. Killed her, and no one just knew, because wherever he would go across the U.S., he would just change his name.
Could you imagine how it?
What?
Never mind.
How easy it was to do that back
yes.
then.
Yeah.
Yes, like
to just like leave yes, the state like, and then change
like,
your
oh,
name.
Like, oh, I just want to change my name. Like, commit any crimes I want. I'm gonna change my
also,
name.
We
anyway.
Need to stop with the cool nicknames for serial killers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
like the Chameleon Killer is pretty cool. But that guy is not.
Yeah, no, he's not.
You call him the Poopy Pants Killer or something.
That's what I'm talking about. The Poopy Pants Unfaithful Monster Killer.
Yeah, so what the case is, they just really have no concrete evidence to say, like, who killed these 4 women. Well, women and 3 girls. But the best theory they have is the Chameleon, the Poopy Pants Killer. Did it because, you know, he maybe was trying to get rid of his side family. He didn't.
Which, like, also, like, the police saying, yeah, we found the youngest girl is related to both the woman who was found in the drum and this man. We're not sure if they're romantically
yeah,
involved.
Not,
like,
I don't want to hedge any bets. But yeah, no, that was my case, and I'm betting that it probably was him who did it, and that he just wanted to, like,
oh yeah.
Start over again. It was like, I can't be tied down with the family.
Fits the modus operandi for sure.
Yeah, and he died in prison due to illness. Like he didn't even get beat up or anything, which is sad.
Jeff being a sick fuck.
I'm sick.
Sunglasses come on. But yeah,
they call me the Chameleon Killer.
Have you heard of me?
Now you see me. Now you don't.
Hey. Yo,
shit, so sick, I died in prison.
But yeah, but that was that's the end of the iceberg. It was fun getting down here. It was a pretty.
These were such fun.
Yeah,
cases.
It was.
I love.
Yeah, I love a good dark twist. I think my favorite may have been the hotel one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
that's just terrifying.
Just peak weirdness.
Especially just because, like, people kept going in and out of there. And, like, nothing's
there,
going
there
on.
There were so many, innocent bystanders involved.
Like,
I don't know, but the government conspiracy one's probably my
favorite. That's good, too.
Yeah, just because, man, the FBI.
But poor Mary. Like, she was hitting the bottle after that. Because that's some shit.
You earned it.
Hard to go into more rooms after that.
Yeah, I can never be a mate again. Mary the mate. Back then, they all had such, like, what's the word where things, the names just rhyme? Can't think of it. But, like, back then, everyone's named, yeah.
Anagram?
Ampersand? I don't know. I just feel like back then, everyone's name just kind of rhymed with their last name, which is just great. We should bring that back. But, this was fun.
Yeah.
Had a bunch of fun. Do you want to plug your show again?
Sure. Well, first off, thank you guys so much for letting me come on and be awkward.
Thank you for being here.
We're
all awkward.
It's
all right.
We're all awkward.
Okay, good. just a little bit of talking, and I felt at home. So, if y'all ever want me to come on again, I will be less awkward then.
The hell
yeah. Maybe y'all can come on my show next.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But anyway, my show is Let's Get Dark, and you can find us really just anywhere: Spotify, iTunes, wherever you listen to podcasts. And again, it's just creepy stuff, pretty much. Creepy and crappy stuff that I want to talk about and let people know what's going on in the world.
It's a lot more of this, and I hope that, like, the iceberg thing gives you some ideas for episodes, because there's a lot of good cases.
Yeah, I did research for like four of them, so I'm like, I can use this for.
I gotta put a pen in there.
Oh, that's like the way that I chose my case as I was reading them, and as I was reading them, I was like, holy shit. Oh, no, this is the one.
this is the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
I'd like to see like another one as well for paranormal stuff.
Ooh, that would be cool.
Maybe we should make up one.
Yeah, we should.
But yeah, so
I mean, bam,
that's an episode.
Yeah, we don't need other people to give us our ideas. It's okay.
organically sorts our true crime. But yeah, no, this was great. Had a bunch of fun. And yeah, that's it. Peace out. Kisses from the homies. We all love you. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Yeah.
We are clear.
From the jungle, up in the trees, I got a few tricks up in the sleeve. One wrong move, I'ma let out the shoes, check out the crease. Blow like I'm Bigfoot, step on the beat. Make a man's run till he step out the crease. When the whole place scream, gotta get out the on display. 1, 2, 3 a day, I'm on my way. I'ma have you on tiptoes, watching my diamond afterglow. I know you wanna take me home, I'm on my way.
I don't need your money, you can pay me in respect. Cause once I do it big, what's to follow is a check. I need 100 bags, nothing more, nothing less. And the ops feel away, cause I'm next, I'm a threat. You can't take back them things you already done. No. You blame things that you do on somebody else. No. But they all see is you need help. You waste all of your time helping up your.
I love it when you kiss.